We will divide our study of the Rule of the Master into two parts. This first will be an introduction, a rather general description of the rule and some of its contents, and then the second part will be a rather closer look at some specific passages that illustrate the points that we'll be making in just a moment. The reason for looking at this document is that it, together with the Rule of Benedict, provides a very basic and beautiful model for an introduction to Christian spiritual training, to asceticism from the monastic perspective. For those who may be unfamiliar with the Rule of the Master, let me say a few things about it. We call it the Rule of the Master because it is anonymous. We do not know who wrote it. He refers to himself as the master in the text, and that's why it carries the title that it has. It has been known widely since the 9th century, when a compilation of monastic rules became rather widely disseminated in the Christian West, and it was thought to be an expansion of the Rule of Benedict. It was thought to be a rather unsuccessful attempt to add things to Benedict's rule, because it's three times longer than the Rule of Benedict, and many of the elements that it contains, on which people have tended in antiquity and also to some extent in modern times to focus, so many of these elements seem to be very idiosyncratic or even silly, and some of them are rather dark and oppressive in terms of their emphasis on strictness and obedience. But we now know, very careful comparison of these documents, of the Master with Benedict, have made it very clear that in fact the relationship is the other way around. The Rule of the Master, for all of its great length, came first, and Benedict used it as his principal source. Thus, for those of us who follow the Rule of Benedict or are interested in the Rule of Benedict, either to use in our own personal lives or as an example of Christian spiritual training and how it was understood in the 5th and 6th centuries, the Rule of the Master is an important predecessor, a document Benedict used and adapted, which in many ways illustrates Benedict's own genius, his ability to craft and shape and modify even something that was very large and in some ways unwieldy. But I would like, as much as possible, to try to correct what Father Adalbert de Vogüé has said is a tendency among modern Benedictines and those who follow or are interested in the Rule of Benedict, and that is to look exclusively on the negative aspects of the Rule of the Master, to have a very condescending or at best skeptical attitude towards this work. In fact, it has to be described as a work of genius. The way it describes the Christian life and the specific monastic project in outline is very beautiful, and it provides a tremendously well-crafted structure which Benedict adapts and in some cases incorporates word for word into his own rule. But as we'll see, it also has its darker and oppressive side. But I'd like for us to look first at the structure of this introduction. This is what corresponds to the prologue in the Rule of Saint Benedict, and as you'll see here, it consists of four parts: a prologue, a theme or parable, a story of the spring or fount of water, which is given to the thirsty travelers, a beautiful parable that sets up the whole notion of what it means to be on a spiritual journey and to find one's home in Christian community and under Christian leadership. Then a theme pater, and all of these are listed in the little box at the top of the page, which is effectively a commentary on the Lord's Prayer, on the Our Father, and what has been called in modern times the theme sequence. This is a commentary on Psalms 33 in the old numbering, the Vulgate and Septuagint numbering, or 34 in the modern numbering, and Psalm 14 or 15. This structure, and by the way, those names, theme pater and theme sequence, are modern terms which are sometimes confusing to people, but which have been used since the publication of the critical edition of the text, and therefore are unlikely to be changed. This structure of the division of this introduction to this rule into four gives us a very clear sense of one of the more brilliant aspects of this rule, and that is that the Master has decided to organize and describe Christian spiritual striving according to the model of baptism, basing firmly the idea of Christian spiritual progress in the baptismal covenant, so much so that even at this time, when infant baptism had been the norm for several centuries already, nevertheless, the tradition of rites of initiation was still, as it were, fresh in people's liturgical memory, and so the Master could draw upon that. And we might say that in many ways, what his rule is doing is inviting Christians to reinvigorate themselves, to discover again the zeal and excitement that knowing what baptism is all about can do. And it's on that basis, the discovery of what our baptism is, that he lays out his program of spiritual growth. And again, this division into four parts is an adaptation of baptismal catechesis. His own introduction, the theme which we will look at in more detail in the next lecture, the story of the stream and of the very dry desolate wanderers, then the commentary on the Our Father, which reminds us that in the ancient tradition of baptism of adults, part of the instruction to those who were to be baptized was to pass on to them, traditio was the word, to hand on that which they were then to memorize and have as their own. And this always included the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer. So the theme pater, after a description of the model of baptism, is a reminder of this handing on of the Lord's Prayer, which would have been done in ancient times by the bishop to those who were to be received in baptism. The theme sequence, with its commentary on two psalms, is a reminder of the fact that in some churches, particularly the churches of Naples and of North Africa, there was also the tradition of giving to the newly baptized psalms which were easy to memorize, which were very brief and easy to hold in one's heart. Thus, the catechumens and the neophytes, those who were new in the church and being received with the rites of initiation, would have memorized and have available to them for their own meditation and recitation in their hearts both the Our Father and psalms, the meaning of which would have been explained to them. This is the structure that the Master uses in introducing his program of spiritual exercise for those Christians who are called to live in monasticism. And one has to acknowledge that this is a very beautiful and profound structure for a model of Christian spiritual growth, rooting it in baptism and recovering again a sense of reflection on the Our Father and on the simple psalmody that one is taught as, one might say, a daily renewal in catechesis. The model that the Master will be setting up is that what happened in baptism and the beautiful instruction in the faith that accompanied it is something that should be real for us now, in our life of ongoing conversion. We use the models and examples that we receive from that catechesis as something that can be ever fresh, ever awake for us each day. If we just look down very briefly to the structure of the rule and make ourselves aware of some of the things that he does within it, let me just say that two of the other very important and positive elements that he includes are a notion of the school of the Lord's service. If you drop all the way down to the bottom of this text, number 45 of the last portion, that is to say, number 45 of the theme sequence, you will see, it's 45 and 46, that he establishes a school of the Lord's service. And this image of the monastic community as a schola, as a place where one progresses in knowledge, is a very beautiful and enduring one, although we'll see that it has its darker elements in the Master, which Benedict beautifully modifies in his own rule. And the other element that needs to be mentioned, although we won't look at the particular text of that at this moment, is the idea of the yoke of Christ. He speaks about the yoke or burden of sin that we carry and how we must instead take on the sweet, light yoke of Christ. again, very beautiful images, very powerful metaphors that will echo throughout the centuries, not only within the monastic tradition, but also in the church at large, as models of what it means to commit oneself to a life of ongoing conversion. And in our second lecture, we will look at the specific elements of the different portions of this introduction to the rule of the master.